and welcome to another episode of the Send Mum Club podcast. This is the parenting podcast with a difference because it's all about raising our wonderful children with Sen. My name is Gemma, I'm your host. And welcome along if you're new here. It's amazing to have you. Thank you if you're a regular listener. And I know that some of you, because you've told me on Instagram, have kind of built listening to the podcast into your routines, you know, whether it's the school run or walking to nursery or walking your dog on a certain day. So I love that so much. And it makes me feel like I'm doing something worthwhile with this podcast. So I really appreciate you, whether you're new or whether you've been around for ages. I want to start, I'm going to be honest, by having a small moan about the weather. I am so done. I'm a very cold person anyway. I don't mean emotionally, I'm quite the opposite. But in terms of like physicality, like I literally get cold bones. I've got rhinoids, which look like dead people's fingers, which is hugely attractive. But the biggest problem I'm finding, and I know I'm not alone in this, is my God, the illness. So my son Leo is 3. And I swear to God, over this winter, there's been about 3 days where he's been well. And in those 3 days, I went, oh my God, he's not ill. And I feel very fortunate that these illnesses, he has been admitted to hospital once with slightly low oxygen because of his chest. And I know that there are people who listen to this podcast who have it much harder, but just in a general sense, I cannot wait till he is not ill all the time, which also means that I won't be ill all the time because, my God, I know his immune system is still developing. I feel like mine is as well. I didn't used to get sick ever. My other two kids didn't do this to me. He's given me recently, I would say in the last probably 4 months, he's given me every cough and cold he's had. He's given me COVID, which then for me turned into sinusitis for 4 or 5 weeks, which was incredibly painful. He has just given me conjunctivitis. Luckily, he had it very mildly. I am now on a course of 7 days of antibiotics for mine because I've never seen conjunctivitis like it on a person before. And just as I start those antibiotics and they're kicking in, he's now got another cold and I have got swollen glands in my throat. So Leo and winter, thank you, but enough now. Right, I'm going to stop moaning. I feel a bit better. That was quite cathartic. So if you're still here, thank you so much. Now, this week's episode, I'm really excited about. Do you remember ages ago, I did an expert episode with my friend Naomi, who's a therapist. And I said to you then that I was going to do more expert episodes, which basically means I get someone on who really, really knows their stuff. And you get the opportunity to ask questions that you need some support with or some advice with or something that you're struggling with. So this week, my expert is Claire Wally, who is the Sen expert. And she really is. Now, Claire has got the answers to all of the questions. And I love this so much. Now, I learned so much in this episode. Thank you to all of you who got in touch on Instagram with the questions that you wanted answers to. I think you'll agree by the end that Claire did a fabulous job with that advice and those answers. So in this chat, we talk about the process of getting an EHCP if your child isn't in a school setting, so you haven't kind of got them to help. We talk about appealing a DLA decision. We talk about the school's legal requirement to provide what is on an EHCP. We talk about term time holidays for children with additional needs. We discuss a question from Kate about looking after a child with very complex needs. Kate's actually been on the podcast before. She was a great guest. And how are you meant to basically look after your child and have a job when everything is so full on? We talk about emotional-based school avoidance, which is a great question from Sean. And that kind of grey area where your child's needs are too low for a SEN provision but too high for mainstream. So we kind of cover a lot in this episode. Hopefully you will find this really interesting. And, you know, maybe you're past this point. Maybe these questions aren't relevant to you, but you know someone who they would be. So if that is you, I would love you to pass this episode on, or maybe just have a listen and pass the information on. Like, let's share and help each other, because that's one thing that I found about the Sen community. That's a lie, I found lots of things. But one lovely thing that I found is that everybody is so supportive and everybody wants to help each other and share that information just to make things a little easier. Okay, I'm going to be quiet now. Let's get into the episode. Mm-hmm. Claire, thank you for joining me on the podcast.
It's absolutely fine. Lovely to be here.
I'm going to start off by saying that my son Leo, it's his nap time and he's at the moment categorically refusing a nap. So I'm watching him on the camera. So if anyone hears any strange noises in the background, that will be him like, no, no nap, which is obviously extremely useful when I'm trying to work. So Claire, you are the Sen expert. So this is another expert episode that I've got. I've done one before. But Claire, I think it would be really interesting and useful for you to answer some questions that people have sent in. And I've got some brilliant questions from people. But before we get onto that, I'd love to just know how, well, a bit about you really, and what led you to setting up your business?
Seems ages ago now, 16, nearly 17 years ago, I completed my teacher training, like most people. Headed straight down to London because I wanted to go and live with where all my friends lived. And I got my first teaching job as an art teacher in a school in Wembley. It was an interesting school for me because it was an area of high disadvantage, absolutely ginormous school. And I went in and on my first day, they said, you're going to have a SEN tutor group and you're going to teach them for 25 hours a week. So bear in mind, secondary school timetable is 30. So yeah, 25 hours a week, you're going to have these children. They're in year seven. They've got a range of very complex needs from autism to, we had some children with quite severe mental health challenges. There was physical difficulties. And essentially the school was saying, they're not allowed out of that room and you're with them and you've got to teach them everything and get them secondary ready essentially, but by the time they get to year eight. So it was kind of a
backflip. Sorry, can I just interrupt? This was your first teaching job?
Yes. It was a bit of a
backflip. That's a lot.
Yeah, really. So I walked in with my paintbrush, like ready to go. Let's like do some colour wheels. And I suddenly was thrust into this world of designing a very holistic and creative curriculum for these children. And I absolutely loved it. That's where it kind of got my fire going, I suppose, for SEN. And then I just kind of went through the ranks doing different SEN roles in schools in London. I worked in the States for a bit, which was really interesting, in a boarding school with a high number of children with additional needs. As you can imagine, the Americans have a very different approach to support for children with additional needs. So I, again, was able to have that kind of holistic approach because I also was working with them in the dorm houses as well as being art teacher, SEN person as well. So that was really enjoyable. Then I came back to the UK and just had this real fire for special educational needs and wanted to do right by the kids. And I probably shouldn't say this, but I used to get in all sorts of trouble because I was like, well, why can't we do this differently? Why is there a threshold on that? Or why are we, I don't know, excluding this child for doing whatever behaviour when they've got ADHD? Let's think about this in a logical fashion as opposed to a ridiculous one. So off I went through various schools. I've worked in the West Midlands in Birmingham, worked in the Southwest for a bit, then came back to London. I worked as a SEN advisor for an academy chain and then assistant head, deputy head. And my final school was in Brixton. A huge SEN needs in this particular school, but also massive safeguarding ones as well. So I was in charge of SEN and safeguarding. And again, I loved it. I loved kind of getting, sounds really nosy, but getting involved in these children's lives and making sure that when they left school at 3 o'clock, it wasn't just that off you go, we've helped you till three and now this is off you go and find your own way. But on that journey, I was always hit with this like, well, we can't do it that way. Or no, if we let this child have the support they need, then everyone will want it. And I'm like, well, isn't that kind of a good thing as opposed to gatekeeping? So then the SEN expert was born because I just got fed up of answering to people that weren't giving the answers I wanted. So I was on maternity leave and my daughter Cleo was 4 months old and I was pushing around in the pram, putting up posters that looked like this, and they're still stuck up now in the streets near my house. And the whole idea around it was to support parents, children, young people, professionals and schools with this kind of honest, frank approach to special educational needs, because there's too much fobbing off, there's too much waffle, there's too many sort of chiefs and not enough people that are telling kind of the honest truth, I suppose. So that's where it all started from, and it's gone crazy. So now from me and Cleo being the only employees essentially, we've now got a team of 25. They work all across the SEN space, which is amazing. So we get to see SEN from so many different angles. We've got a lawyer, we've got people that work at local authorities, EPs, people in schools. So we have just sort of crafted this very honest and frank, sometimes blunt, potentially a bit rude to people we need to be rude to, hive mind, I suppose, of support for children with additional needs. And that's how I've got to where I am now, which is a bit of a waffly way of explaining it, but yes.
No, it's great. And aside from the obvious, because I am obviously a SEN parent myself, my son has Down syndrome. So aside from my personal feelings of this is great that there are you and people like you doing what you do, I also love in your story that you set this up when you were on maternity leave, because I feel like most mums that I speak to, me included, all my friends, you're on maternity and you have these big plans and you go, I'm going to set something up for myself. And then most people don't do that and then just go back to work. And I love that you did that. And especially with a 4-month-old baby, that's impressive.
It was an interesting way to spend a maternity period. Usually you're meant to be going to like music class. And I did go to music class and various other things, but I don't know whether it's a failing or a strength, but I'm massively impatient, which has helped me loads with my SEN expert work. Because when, as you know, probably with support for your son, you just have to wait and you have to wait for people to reply and everything's so slow. So I was like, right, well, I'm going to do it. So let's just get on with it. So my impatience, which sometimes gets me in trouble, actually was a benefit whilst setting it up during maternity leave.
I am also an extremely impatient person, so hard relate to that. Right, so some of my lovely listeners and followers on Instagram have been in touch with some questions that they want to know the answers to. But what was interesting is reading down these questions, although they have come from specific people, I don't feel like they're particularly niche questions. I feel like they're probably questions that a lot of my listeners will at some point either need to know the answer to or have needed to know the answer to in the past. So the first question has come in from Nina, and she wanted to know, how do you go about getting an EHCP if your child isn't in nursery or school yet? Because obviously your educational setting helps you with that process, don't they, usually? But how does that work if your child isn't there yet?
So it's a really timely question because, and we'll probably go on to this later, but EHCPs you've probably seen in the news are potentially up for change. So if you're considering getting an EHCP, sort of time's of the essence and get an application in would be my first point to Nina. To answer her question, the EHCP support window is from 0 to 25 years. The whole idea behind them is that it's meant to support children with that early intervention leading all the way through to young adulthood so they can be successful young adults in whichever community they choose to be a part of. So in theory, from zero, you can apply for an EHCP. As you've probably known from being a SEN parent yourself, though, there seems to be lots of different rules and regulations put in place by local authorities that are different to what's in the SEN Code of Practice, which is the law that sits under everything. So my sort of, I suppose, top tips for Nina would be, if you've got professional reports that demonstrate a level of need, that's really useful. You don't have to have a diagnosis to get an EHCP. You need to be able to demonstrate a presentation of a need. There's a legal test within the SEN Code of Practice that is kind of the gatekeeping process for EHCP applications. And the first part of that legal test is a demonstration of a presentation of need. And then the second is that the child needs additional help or support more so than someone of their chronological age. That is usually the school bit. That's where schools say, oh, you know, we had to put this intervention in place, or we had to, get support from a speech and language therapist. But there's no reason why you couldn't demonstrate that difference in ability in a different setting. Lots of children are home educated, for example, they have EHCPs. It doesn't have to be, oh, I'm physically in the classroom for that support to be considered. One group of people in this whole scenario who's going to maybe cause, you know, a bit of an issue is local authority, because they'll say, well, we need to have evidence from a school, but legally they don't. So always fall back onto that SEN Code of Practice, the legal test. You can Google it. It's about 6 sentences long, but that is going to be your friend in this scenario.
And logistically, how would you like, is there a form that you download, or how do you literally start the process?
So every local authority frustratingly, has a slightly different form, which is
of course,
because like, why make this simple? So the easiest option would be to get us to do it for you. That would be the nice way. So we do hundreds of EHP applications, but if you are wanting to go alone, go onto the local authority website. They should have a downloadable form. They will hide it and millions of paragraphs of like rubbish information. There'll be a tiny little link and it will say parental application for EHCP assessment. Click that, fill it in, send it in. Also, you don't legally have to fill out their lovely forms that someone's crafted in a local authority office somewhere. You can just write a letter of application. And those letters can take any format. The key things to put in those letters are those two legal test points. So a description of the presentation of need, and then a summary of how the child is either being supported in school because they have struggles around something that a child of a similar age wouldn't have, or in Nina's case, if school isn't a part of that process yet, how are they seeing gaps and challenges for that child?
Okay, fantastic. That's all really useful information. And you've already highlighted what I find really frustrating to listen to, because we're actually about to start our EHCP process. So I haven't experienced this personally yet, although I have with the DLA, to be fair, that they make everything so much harder than it needs to be to even start the process of getting something that actually your child is entitled to.
Yeah, no, it's a massive frustration of mine. One thing, it's a very weird thing to like, but I do enjoy a good EHCP. And because we cover the whole country, I get to see every different local authority's iteration of what their application form is or what their thresholds are, like what are they saying yes to, what are they saying no to. I just find it fascinating. But you're exactly right. There is a huge amount of bureaucracy and, let's put it bluntly, like fobbing off, really. If we make this hard for you to do, then maybe some of the parents won't apply. Therefore, we don't have to support, I don't know, five parents that walked away as opposed to the five that decided to take the fight on. And that's not how we should be functioning as a society. I think you can judge a country by how it supports its most needy people. And if we make even the first step of finding a form on a bloody website difficult, that's not putting us in a good light, really. And that's, it makes me quite sad to think that this kind of the amount of paperwork required to get a child support. It's not that you shouldn't have to fight for that. It should be, we want to help these young people to make them successful adults. And I mean, it's probably a bit bleak, but if you look at the other end, we talk a lot about childhood, but if you look at young adulthood and adults with additional needs, the cost of placing a young adult in supported living for adult social care is absolutely ginormous, way more than your average cost of an EHCP. The prison population, 60% have got some form of special educational need. Now, what happens if those people were supported in school so they were able to make choices when they were younger that meant that they didn't end up in the prison system? And the prison system to house like a single prisoner is thousands of pounds a year. Why not invest that in an EHCP and not have someone sat in a prison cell with their life wasted and public funds being spent on, you know, keeping them locked up? Sorry, that is a bit bleak, but it frustrates me when they're not thinking about it the right way around, I think.
Yeah. I heard a stat, and you might know, I might have this slightly wrong, but I heard a really, again, depressing stat about the EHCP appeal process recently, that it was quite a high number of EHCPs get rejected. Yeah. And then I think it was something crazy that I read that 98% of people then get through on the appeal.
Yes. So it's a particular type of appeal. So it's the refusal to assess. So imagine the situation you're in with your son at the moment. So you go and apply and the local authority is saying no. You are then given the right to appeal at that point. Because the legal test in the SEN Code of Practice is so broad and really quite good, it's supportive, it gives children a lot of rights. As soon as you get to the hearing, the parents win because the judge is applying the law. The judge is not applying what, I don't know, Karen from the local authority says in her email back to you. Where local authorities trip up is that they're saying no at the wrong point. So along your EHCP journey, there's the point where you're requesting to be assessed. So you're basically saying, please, can you assess me? Then you're assessed. So professionals will go into school, nursery, or wherever and assess the child. They then provide professional evidence. that goes to the local authority, who then either agree to issue the plan or not based on what the professionals say. Now, by all means, say no at the point of issue, because you've got the evidence to base your decision on. You can't say no at the point of, oh, I'm refusing to even see if you need help. And that's why they lose the tribunals so much, because they're saying no at the wrong point. So as soon as the judge claps eyes on it, they're like, well, they do meet the legal test. They've got a presentation of need and something different's happened for them in school. So local authorities, you lose. And the amount of money that they spend on preparing for these appeals is absolutely ginormous. I was looking at it the other day. So since 2014, I think it's £485 million has been spent on fighting parents in tribunals, as opposed to helping the children that are in need. And local authorities are really quite cunning, I think, in the process. So I deal with a huge amount of appeals. I've got, looking at my board here now, I've got 27 open appeals at the minute that we're supporting parents with. And I guarantee you, 80% of them, about 2 weeks before the hearing date, once the parents put all their effort in collating the evidence, we've written up executive summaries, we've done all the admin, 2 weeks before, they'll ring up and be like, oh yeah, we'll concede actually. So making you go through that hearing process is essentially a delaying tactic, because if I can push you down the line by 12 months, 18 months, I don't have to pay for your child to have additional support during that period of time. But the majority of our refusal to assess appeals will just concede, but like 2 weeks before the hearing date, as opposed to like at the start, when in theory, the entire hearing process is meant to be one of negotiation. And you're meant to be going back and forth with the local authority saying, okay, well, what about if we did this? Or what if I got you this bit of evidence? But we're seeing more and more this kind of, I don't know whether I'm being slightly cynical, but it feels like a tactical delaying process and then just conceding at the last minute before they have to click book on whichever crappy lawyer they're going to hire to represent them for the hearing day.
But it's almost like they're trying to get people to go, do you know what? This is too much. I can't.
Yeah, 100%. I think that's why our support services around appeals is so popular, because it is it's an intimidating process. Even, you know, the paperwork that you get sent looks, it's from the courts, it looks scary. We just see so much of it that we're not fazed by it at all. And I think they use that as a means, like you say, a certain percentage of people will be put off from that and they'll walk away from the process. Whereas actually the appeals process, very similarly to the SEN Code of Practice, is a good thing. It's a safety net. It's there to protect our children's rights. So you shouldn't be, not scared, but you shouldn't be kind of like encouraged to walk away from that by a local authority who is a public service that is meant to serve the public, if that makes sense.
You said you can Google that, didn't you?
Oh, the legal test?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so for anyone who's listening who might be driving or walking the dog or doesn't, you know, has missed what you've said, I'm going to make sure that I put a link in the show notes to that, so it's very easy for everybody to find if you need it. Speaking of appeals, Carly messaged on Instagram to say that she has been rejected, well, not she, but her child has been rejected for the disability living allowance. Is there an appeal process for that, or is that just a straight no if you get
there's
rejected?
There's an appeals process for that as well. It does take a while, but you can appeal the decision made around disability living allowance. The service will contact you and they will ask for you to engage with a mediation service sometimes, where you go and talk to them and they'll sort of talk to the department that deals with the DLA. But yes, you can definitely appeal. It may be that you need to provide more evidence. It may also be that when you filled out the form initially, there were some bits that you didn't get quite right. They're very hot on sort of types of wording, meaning certain things. And the main point of DLA is to support with care and to support with mobility needs. So I did a post on my Instagram about parents writing about meltdowns in their DLA form. So a meltdown for an autistic child is a huge event. It causes a lot of issues within a family, but also brings out a lot of care needs, right? But if you put my child has meltdowns on a DLA form, that's not ticking the boxes in terms of what care needs are required to support that child in that moment. So it's a good point to sort of think on, is how you're filling that form in. So if every event that you're listing is something that's happening to your child, you have to think about it in terms of, well, what care did that result in? Because that's what they're trying to support you with. They're trying to support you with the care. They're not going to support you with the meltdown. And if you kind of list all of the time, the hours that you put in as a family to support a child that may have meltdowns, it's huge. So it can be things around the sensory environment. It can be things around routines and structuring home life. It could be about the interactions they have with other children or professionals, or how you can go out and, I don't know, go to a play date or not, or go to a party or not. So it's about flipping it on its head from thinking like, okay, my child had a meltdown, but actually what is the time cost? It sounds really awful, but the time cost of that meltdown on the care needs for the family. So that might have been a reason why that particular application was rejected. Also, if you've ever seen a DLA form, oh, they're trying to put you off with that one, because it's about 5,000 pages long and it's listing, you know, minutes of so many minutes for this activity, so many minutes for that. And again, that can put parents off as well.
Yeah, I think, and this sounds silly, but when we filled in our DLA form, something that I felt made it harder personally was the fact that you can't do it online. So you're literally having to write by hand everything that you're trying to say. And that, for me personally, just made it feel a bit more laborious than being able to type it, delete something that wasn't quite right, go, you know, save it, go back. It makes it take longer.
You can fill them in online, but it's not an easy process because the boxes are fit fit to a certain size. So often what I do when I support families with DLA applications is we'll provide supporting evidence. So in every box where you have the opportunity to write, we would just put please see attached evidence, and then we'd have a statement that'd be far, far longer than the little tiny box that they give you to apparently summarize your child's entire needs in a tiny little box. So yeah, there's opportunity to provide more information, but I think the key thing is that information has to be around what care happened because of XYZ.
Yeah, and it's an interesting point that you've made there, because I would consider myself to be quite an intelligent person. I've never needed any help with any kind of forms or admin or anything before. And luckily, somebody gave me the heads up about the DLA form. So we accessed some support to fill that in. Because of exactly what you're saying, if you don't, it's not embellishing the truth, but it's writing things in the right way that, like you said, that will tick those boxes. So we got support to fill ours in, and we got the DLA. We are receiving the DLA. My friend, whose son is slightly younger than mine, has Down syndrome, I would say a probably similar level of need, got rejected.
Yeah.
And I would assume that that is because some of that wording on the form isn't what they wanted to see.
And also it's not a nice process to be writing a form about challenges that your child has. I think that's why we've been successful with so many families, because we can provide that kind of degree of separation. And to get the highest level of support, you need to present them on their trickiest day. And I feel so bad for parents when they send me lists or summaries of their child, and it's full of strengths and good things and brilliant things this child can do. And that I want to hear that, but then I have to take that and say, okay, well now, how can we tweak this strength to actually be a challenge? Because that means that you'll get this level of support. So I think for parents, it can be a really quite soul-destroying experience. And like you said, getting support, I would strongly recommend it, because it gives you that degree of separation. I've got some parents who send me all their information and they say, you fill it and I don't want to look at it. And I just send it in on their behalf, because it's a means to an end. You know, once that form's gone in, no one's ever going to see it again. But some of the things in it can be, they could just be quite upsetting, really, because a child isn't a list of things that they don't do very well. A child is a list of their strengths, but that doesn't get them the highest level of support. And it's back to front, really.
100%. And I feel that as a parent, and my husband really struggled with this, because what we are used to doing as parents is going, no, my child's brilliant. They will be able to achieve that. They can do this. And if they can't do it now, you know, we're going to do everything to support them and have the highest hopes. And like you said, you're having to literally do the opposite of that on a form. And it in all honesty, I've mentioned this on the podcast before, it threw me for about a week. It made me feel really quite depressed, like looking at all the people that he was under and having to write the very worst things. although it is just a form, that was a really negative emotional experience for me. And I know I won't be alone in that either.
No, definitely. And I think what's silly is you would be writing down all the list of the professionals that are working with your son, and they're all trying to help and they're doing positive work to make things better. But yeah, you have to present it in a certain way to tick boxes. And I mean, once the boxes are ticked and you've got the support, you know, let's focus on the positives, because that's what we're trying to do here. We're trying to help these children achieve and thrive and, you know, have really amazing lives. But yeah, the paperwork piece of the SEN space is sometimes not a pleasant place to hang out in, really.
No, absolutely not. So I've had a message from Davina, and she said, does a school have to provide everything that is named on an EHCP? The example she's given is a one-to-one, or can they say that they can't afford it? So basically, I think what she's asking is, if your EHCP names a one-to-one, do you then automatically get the funding for your child to have a one-to-one? And I'd quite like to know this, because I'm hearing different experiences of this from people.
So from a legal standpoint, yes. So an EHCP is a contract between the local authority and the school. And in the EHCP, there are three sections that are legally binding. Section B, which is a summary of the child's needs. Section F, which is provision, which is where your one-to-one will sit. And section I, which is the naming of a school place. The local authority should fund section F so that it's completely actionable within a school. So if it says in your section F part that there is a one-to-one, then that should be funded. I imagine where your listener is finding difficulty is, as with everything to do with the SEN system, local authorities don't necessarily follow the letter of the law. There was huge issues around funding and central government not funding local authorities to make these EHCPs actually function. So what I'm seeing a lot of schools saying is, oh, well, your EHCP says we've got a one-to-one, we can't afford that. So what the school should at that point be saying is, we're going to request more funding from the local authority, or sorry, we can't meet your child's needs. You're going to have to go back to the local authority and ask them to consult some other schools. And lots of parents end up in this horrible like limbo situation where they're not doing anything wrong. The local authority aren't funding the school with what they need, but the school are also not necessarily using their power to say to the local authority, okay, cool, well, if you're not going to give us the one-to-one funding, then we're out, we can't help this kid. So you have these horrible situations where it's kind of mum and dads or whoever carers get upset with school because they feel like they're not doing what the EHCP says, but the school can't do what the EHCP said because it's not fully funded. Now, I mean, I could talk about this for hours, but what happened probably around the time when the SEN code of practice came out. So we used to have statements of special educational need. That was an old fashioned EHCP. Then they turned into EHCPs, and statements used to list hours of support. So it would be like, Joe Bloggs gets 15 hours of one-to-one TA support a week, and that costs, I don't know, £800 a week or something, and then it works out how much you get per annum. But because there's lots of savvy parents in the SEN space, what was happening was, if a child was going into school and they didn't have their one-to-one hour, a lot of parents were saying, well, actually, I'm going to keep a tally of this. My child's meant to have 15 hours a week, and this week they only had 10, so you owe me X amount of hours that have been missed. So rather than solving the problem by making sure that a child was supported as they legally should be, local authorities moved away from stipulating hours in EHCPs and instead giving a total amount of money, so say, I don't know, 10 grand a year, but they wouldn't say, and that equates to how many hours of one-to-one. They would rephrase that. So they would say, Joe Bloggs would be supported by a trusted adult throughout the day. So that isn't something that can be pinned down. I can't go in and say, well, I meant to get 15 hours and you've only given me 10, because the wording suddenly becomes waffly. And there's lots of EHCPs that I've seen across the years where it's just like a big old waffle fest. And the reason why it's done is because it's not accountable. You can't count up how many times a supported adult may have interacted with the child when it's not stipulated in a kind of hour format. So that's a very long-winded way of answering the question. But legally, if it's in Section F, it should be provided. But I would check the wording, because I would be highly doubtful that in 2026 she's got a EHCP that says Joe Bloggs gets 15 hours of support. It might be referenced loosely, but that'll be how the local authorities kind of fiddle that wording. Fiddle sounds a bit wrong, but you know, set it up so they're not accountable, because that's what was happening historically, and parents are holding to account and they didn't like it. And they also don't have the funding from central government to make it happen. So it's, there's issues in every camp around that.
Yeah. Okay. Next question is from Becky, and she says, do school legally have to authorise term time holidays if your child has a diagnosis, or is that up to the school?
So this is a tricky one. In the SEND Code of Practice, there's nothing that says, oh, you need to have X amount of days off for term time holidays because your child's got a particular need. But it can be down to the discretion of the school to say, oh, we're seeing this child is struggling, so they may benefit from a reduced timetable, or maybe having a few days off at the start of a term and an end of a term to kind of ease transition. But there's no clear-cut documentation that says, okay, I don't know, my child's got ASD, therefore I can book my holiday in a term time. The whole attendance piece, I think, is just a mess, because we want children to go to school and enjoy being there. We also want them to have nice lives and be able to go on holidays with their parents and not be able to do that because the summer holidays means that the cost of your flights suddenly triples because of all these awful holiday companies that are making a buck on the fact that everyone's trapped within these quite strict attendance parameters. I don't know of anywhere that is kind of legally documented that because you have a diagnosis, you can do that. On a school by school basis, there's some really great schools out there that probably would agree, because they would see the benefit of a child having some time out of school or with their family doing something that's really lovely, as opposed to forcing them into school when they're, you know, tired, exhausted, having a really tricky time. So I'm probably not giving a very good answer, but I think school by school basis, I think, would be an easier way to go than trying to find a bit of legislation that focuses on that particular bit.
Yeah, because I've spoken to mums before whose children have autism or sensory needs or both, and they need to go away when the hotel or wherever they're staying would be less busy and not absolutely packed, you know, peak summer. It's just not going to work for them as a family.
Yeah, and I think it's a much bigger issue around how do we balance our attendance policies in school so that children are in school and learning, socialising, getting all the good bits of school without penalising them for wanting to have time in a holiday place or destination that meets their needs. I do worry around the attendance piece with the education reforms that are coming, because there's a lot more tightening up around home education, for example. That is a speculation, but the government seems to be very like keen on everyone being in school all the time, and there isn't that kind of nuance around, you know, that might not be the right fit for everybody. So let's make school work when it can work, but when it's not working, if you force people in, it's just going to make problems a lot worse.
But I mean, even removing the SEN element of it, they've just changed the rules as well, haven't they? Was it at the end of last school year, I think, where people are now being taken to court, aren't they? It's like almost like three strikes and you're out, you're in court. Because understandably, and I completely agree with you in the attendance thing, it doesn't work as in its current form. But understandably, say as an example, because I have heard this example used to me by somebody, if you book to go to Disney World in Florida in the summer holidays, and if you look at it 3 weeks earlier, somebody told me it was something crazy, like it was £3,000 cheaper to go in term time. Now, if you're paying a £120 fine for your two children, that's a no-brainer.
Yeah. Now, I saw a thing recently, I think it was on Instagram, and it was a little boy's dad had posted, and they'd taken him out of school and took him on holiday to Rome, and they were studying the Romans. I think he was in year five. And his argument was, I've just given my son like the best experience ever around learning about the Romans, and yet you want to fine me. Like, you're not providing my child with a school trip to Rome. Like, where's the logic in that? And I think, I just think the government's stance on attendance is just off. And people when children aren't in school, it's not just because they're bunking off or because they're lazy and they don't want to be there. There is a very good reason why a child is not attending school. You need to unpick that reason and support it, not slap a fine on a family that may not be able to afford it.
100%. And also, and we'll move on after this, but in terms of teachers, I've got friends who are teachers. They are only able to go on holiday in the school holidays when the prices are sky high, which again, doesn't seem fair.
No, and I think there's been a real move in other sectors to flexible working post-COVID. And being a teacher is probably one of the most inflexible jobs you can have. Everyone's like, oh, well, you get the summer holidays. But when I was teaching, I couldn't go to my friends' weddings because they'd fall on days when, like the day I'd have to travel, I couldn't go. So very bleak, but I remember I couldn't go to a family funeral because the member of my family that passed away wasn't close enough to me to warrant having a day off. Silly things where a colleague of mine wasn't allowed to go to her child's sports day because she would have needed cover. And it's just like the whole point of being a teacher is you're there supporting children and young people, but then you're penalised if you have your own children and you're not allowed to go and sort of support them. But in other sectors, you know, people work from home or they will work a 4-day week or they have split hours. So they work in the office so many hours and maybe do some work in the evenings. And I can see why there's so many teachers leaving the profession because it is not flexible at all.
Moving on to the next question, this has come in from Kate, and she said, how can parents with complex children be expected to work and care for a child 24/7?
It's a very good question. It is a huge challenge and made worse, I think, by the fact that the SEND system is on its knees. In theory, parents should be supported by the EHCP process, by schools, by social care, by health, to help them support their child with their needs, but also be able to support them to be able to parent and keep working. But I think because the SEN system is just so broken, you're finding parents that are having to struggle to work or leave work completely. I've been doing work with a few employers around having our services as an employee benefit. So the employer would work with us. So rather than having a parent at a point of crisis saying, I don't know, I've got to have another day off today for a hospital appointment for my child, and then getting into an issue around attendance, I would then go in, or someone in my team would go in, and we'd support them with their sort of crisis issue, but also help the company understand the SEN needs a bit wider. That's been really successful because the impact on parents' careers is huge. It's something like 40% of SEN parents either go part-time or completely quit whatever career they may have. And it's not about, oh, I don't want to work, so I want to look after my child. A lot of the parents I talk to really love their careers. They are, you know, they've worked so hard, they're professionals in their field. And then all of a sudden it's like, well, now you've got to choose, right? Are you going to go to work or are you going to look after your child? Because the support services that are there aren't actually providing that kind of buffer between I want to go to work, but I also want to look after my child who's got complex needs. I hope with time things improve because we work in a system I think is quite outdated. 20 years ago, parents, well, not necessarily, usually fathers would be going out to work and mothers would be staying home to look after the children. That's not the case anymore. Like, women work and we're professionals and we have really exciting careers, and it shouldn't be that because your child has complex needs that suddenly stops for you. And I think often the parents get lost in that kind of process. People don't realise the emotional impact it has on, say, a mother who's had to quit their career because, you know, they have to support their child who's got additional needs. And obviously they want to. And it's just like this awful battle between, I want to look after my child, but also, I don't know, I used to be a nurse and I loved it and now I can't do it anymore. And that's part of me that's gone. It's just, it's a bit of a horrible battle to be in, really. And also, a good answer. I've just said how bad it is and not given many solutions.
Well, unfortunately, that's the reality though, isn't it? And the amount of guests I've had on whose children have slightly more complex needs, who say, you know, they're in nursery or they're in, you know, some kind of setting, say, for example, 5 days a week, And the amount of people who say they've never got through a week without having the phone call to say you need to come and pick them up. Mm. And I'd be very interested to know what the percentage is of the dads that get phoned by the school or the nursery to come and pick the child up, because realistically it's the mums that get phoned. That's something, I mean, let's not get into that because that'll wind me up, but that is the reality of it. You know, the schools see the mum as the primary carer.
Yeah.
They get phoned, they leave work, and then it makes it incredibly difficult then if you're having to say 1-2 times a week, sorry, I need to leave. Yeah. That's not really sustainable, is it?
Not at all. And also we've had a few cases recently around after school care. So a lot of schools tend to be London-based schools, but they'll buy in an after school care company, like a package, as opposed to it being in-house. And we've had some very interesting conversations where a child with special needs is in the school, their school is named on their EHCP, but then their after-school provider says that they can't meet their needs. So suddenly a parent who thinks they've got it sorted, they found a school, the school's doing a great job supporting their child, suddenly their working day finishes at 3 because the after-school provider won't look after them or is concerned around how they would meet their needs. So it's just a slog at the moment. And I just really hope that things can get better, because it's not a workable system.
Yeah, I've heard that so many times about the issue with wraparound care, like exactly what you've just said. So many people have said that to me, that, you know, school's fine, but then, like you said, whose job finishes at 3 o'clock? I mean, some people might, if you work for yourself and you can, you know, work the hours that fit around your child. But if you work, like you said, as a nurse, or if you work in a 9-to-5 office job where you are required to be in the office to do your job, it doesn't make sense. Yeah. The maths is not mathing there, unfortunately. Okay, and Sian's been in touch again on Instagram, and she's got a 2-part question here, really. She wanted some advice around EBSA, which I'll get you to explain. I'll admit I had to look that up. But again, it's good because I feel like this is educating people on things that they might not have heard of before.
Yeah, so it is emotional-based school avoidance. So it is not that, oh, I don't want to go to school because I don't want to go to school. It is children who have legitimate deep-rooted issues with attending school, usually anxiety-based. It can also be linked to instances of maybe trauma that has happened either within school or within their lives. But them attending school isn't just a case of, oh, they want a day off because they don't want to go in. Children with EBSA can have very physical reactions to actually going in to school or even considering going in. It is a huge sort of social, emotional, mental health issue for a lot of young people. And we're seeing it more and more. So post-COVID, there's loads of children with emotional-based school avoidance, and there should be support services around it. Most schools have someone called an education welfare officer who is supposed to be assisting with supporting children to transition back in. But it is a long, long road. It's not a case of, oh, well, just come in a bit late, you know, on a Monday, and then we'll see how you get on. There has to be a really robust package of support around getting a child to even consider the thought of entering a school building again. I've got a little boy I'm working with at the moment, and even when they drive past the school, that triggers a huge emotional reaction for him. Like he can't even consider going in. And some schools do a really good job, and they will provide staff members that will go into the home and not go home and, like, you know, do work, but just go and be like a mentor and be like, do you want to go for a walk? Or do you want to go, let's go for older kids, let's go get a coffee. And it's keeping like a relationship connection, as opposed to we want you back in because you've got history period 2 and we're just going to chuck you in the classroom and, like, hope for the best. Other schools don't do it so well. I've got a parent whose child has got a huge range of needs, and she showed me this pile of worksheets that were posted home, and she said, well, that's going to be great. Like, what is the point of this? Like, this poor child being made to do a word search, and that was the school's solution to this very, very real mental health issue. So yeah, we're seeing a lot more of it. I think it's because school is a different beast to what it was maybe 10 years ago. There's a lot of pressure around performing, even for children without additional needs, you know, exam pressures, SATs. Some schools have got a lot more stricter in terms of routines and building kind of, I hate it, but like discipline. And, you know, it's not a nice kind of fluffy place to be like it was when I was at school when I was a kid. And you're seeing it a lot more. And a lot of parents are just going full, like, out of the education system and going for home education at that point, because the transition back is very tricky.
And that support you mentioned, should that be available in mainstream as well? Or is that something that's only kind of in place in a specialist school?
No, it should be available in mainstream. I sort of approach with caution. Some education welfare officers or EWOs are fantastic, and they'll think about really kind of creative, nuanced ways of supporting a child back into school. Others are not so, and they're the ones that recommend people for fines. So you just hope that you get a good one, as opposed to one that's like, well, you've hit this percentage mark, so that means that you're going to get a fine, as opposed to why have you hit that percentage mark of lack of attendance? Like, what's going on? But yeah, hope for a good one.
The other part of Sian's message, it's not so much of a question, so I guess this is more, you know, could you provide some clarity or advice on this? She says the lack of suitable education for kids whose needs are too low for a SEN provision but too high for mainstream.
Yes, so the SEN in between is. So there isn't a real, really kind of easy answer for this. I have seen some really fantastic provision for these kind of in the middle children, but in the private sector. But obviously a private school's fees are ginormous. And then if you make, or if a school is providing additional SEN support, the fees are even higher. So often children with EHCPs are the ones that are able to access those types of school. And they do exist and they're amazing. And you walk in and it feels like, I don't know, mainstream primary school, mainstream secondary, but all of the kind of infrastructure, the fabric of the school just has those supports in that is lacking in a mainstream. And that's why those children thrive there, because it's just normal, like being supported and having scaffolds in place to help with certain aspects of their emotional well-being that they might find challenging, or cognitive issues that they might find difficult. It's just woven into part and parcel of the day. And it's not, oh, you have got special needs, so we're going to have to take you out of this lesson because you're going to off here to have an intervention in a room away from everybody else because you're different. And that's what I see an awful lot in mainstream settings, is this idea that they're physically included, but essentially they're excluded. They're in the building, but that's about it as it comes to like the way that they're included, and it doesn't feel very authentic. It feels kind of disgenuine, and that they're sort of sat in a building, but nothing's really happening for them. So for those types of children, they'll sort of, I can't give a clear answer, but a possible solution is you either look to go higher up the system. So you look to seek an EHCP to get into maybe a more specialist setting, or you try and find yourself a mainstream school that's got a really solid reputation around inclusion, a really strong SENCO who's kind of like leading the way in terms of making inclusion authentic as opposed to a bolt-on. And I think a lot of parents tell me how they feel that when their child's got additional needs in a mainstream setting, yes, they're supported, but it's like an add-on. It's not, this is part of your life, this is part of what school feels like. It just feels a bit kind of inauthentic.
And that's a shame, isn't it? Because it obviously shouldn't be like that.
No, not at all. It should be that everybody within their local community can attend their local school and be supported to thrive. Too many kids I see are supported just to survive. And it's like, well, that's, what is that giving them? What benefit does it have for them to, I don't know, fail GCSE geography, when actually we could have taken a child out of that situation and given them some life skills for a couple of hours a week, and they could have, I don't know, got a job in a local cafe or done something that made them feel really good about themselves. And it just feels a bit kind of disjointed. A whole kind of, oh, well, you know, you can go to mainstream, but then what is mainstream actually doing for you?
So I'm going to finish by asking for some general advice for anybody listening. So what advice, Claire, would you give to somebody who is feeling overwhelmed with life as a Zen parent?
You need to find your community or find people like myself and people from the SEN Expert that can support you. Being a parent is tricky enough, as we've spoken on earlier. Being a working parent is even trickier. And then trying to navigate the Zen system, which is currently in a quite a big state of disarray, it's just too much for one person or one family to bear. I think try and find your community. So Instagram, social media is an amazing place to find people who are in similar situations, not just to get advice from, but just to feel like you're not on your own. And also engage with support services. What I try to do with all the work that I do with my families is say, you can be as involved in this process as you want, but also if it's too stressful for you, send me all your paperwork and I'll do it for you and I'll ring you up and tell you when everything's okay. And I think some families just really appreciate that because it's just one thing too many to put on their shoulders when they're already trying to navigate parenting of a child with additional needs, what that brings, and then just life, because it's hard work.
100%. I think every parent will feel that, you know, whether their child has additional needs or not. Sometimes there's that one thing that's the straw that breaks the camel's back and you're like, okay, I'm out. I can't. I'm done.
100%.
Claire, I think all of the information that you've given there and the advice has been super helpful. Thank you so much. Now, if people aren't already following you on Instagram or socials or, you know, online, where can they find you?
So on Instagram, we are the at @ZenExpert. I have recently dallied into the world of TikTok. I don't know if I'm any good at it, but that is the SEN Expert on TikTok. And we also have our website. Our website has got an absolute ton of information on it. And we also have a very exciting new addition where we call it our website experts. I spent ages training this chatbot to actually be vaguely helpful. So you can go and have a conversation on our website with our little website expert, and it will give you a ton of information and direct you to various supports that may be useful. The main way that I get to talk to people is through our advice call. So either on the website or by talking to our little website expert, you can book in some time to have a chat with us. And as I said, there's 25 of us. We've all from different areas of the Zen space. And I think just have a conversation. Don't feel like you're alone, because you are most certainly not alone in the world of SEN, and also not alone in feeling like this system isn't working and we need to do a better job for our children and young people.
I think what you're doing, Claire, is fantastic. I will make sure that all the links for the website and all of your socials and everything are in the show notes so people can very easily find you to access that support if it's something that they feel would help them. And thank you so much for talking to me. Yeah,
thank you very much.
I found that chat so informative with Claire, and I really hope that you did as well. Thank you so much to Kate, to Sean, to Becky, to Davina, Amy, and everyone else who sent in questions. I feel like personally, Claire's answered a lot of things that I needed to know there, and I hope that she's done the same for you. Or maybe if it isn't relevant to you, you know another Zen parent who is at the particular stage maybe of having to appeal an EHCP or appeal the DLA, or is, you know, one of those Zen in-betweeners. So maybe it's a nice opportunity, if none of that felt particularly personal to you, to pass the information on or to send a link to the episode to listen. And in fact, I'd actually love that if people started passing the podcast on. That'd be amazing. So like I said when I was speaking to Claire, all of those links to how to get in touch with the Zen Expert are going to be in the show notes. And I'm also going to make sure that the link to the legal test for the Zen Code of Practice is in there as well, because I know I've written it down. I've already forgotten exactly what it was that it was called, and I've literally just, you know, put the call down to Claire. So I'd imagine I'm not alone in that. So that link will also be in the show notes, because I didn't even know that was a thing before today. So again, I've learned so much. I hope you found this expert episode really helpful. As always, if you have a suggestion for a guest for me, I would love to hear that. If you would like to suggest yourself as a guest, if you think, do you know what? I would love to share my story. I would love to raise awareness for a condition or a disability that my child has. Or maybe you just want to offload. I would love all of that. And you can get in touch with me at the Send Mum Club on Instagram. Please slide into my DMs. I love it. Right. That's it for me for another episode. And I will be back with another brilliant guest for you next week.